This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network.
I'm really excited that today's show is brought to you by FreshBooks, an extremely fast and user-friendly cloud accounting software made by a small business owner for small businesses, entrepreneurs, and anyone who wants to get paid fast. Just go to freshbooks.com/James and enter James in the How Did You Hear About Us section.
Today on the James Altucher Show.
I am passionate about my calling. I am passionate about malaria in Africa. This is a passion. I'm following my passion.
And then, you know, some guy in Ohio is just sitting there playing his video games like, I don't really have a passion. So here's a very embarrassing story. Like, this is one of those classic, like, Altucher kind of things. Like, I shouldn't be saying this, but I'm about to.
These are the only stories. Hey, Derek, this is James Altucher.
Can you hear me?
Oh, my God, you have, like, a radio voice. Your voice sounds great.
Well, thank you for calling.
Seriously, are you using like special equipment or something? Like, what's going on over there?
It's this big Darth Vader mask that I'm speaking through right now. A blue Yeti mic. Hi,
it's great. How are you doing?
Good to finally talk to you. I have spent so many hours with you in my head, whether through your books or articles and all that stuff, that I'm beaming right now. It's an honor to finally talk to you.
Well, probably because I steal so liberally from what you write that you're reading kind of regurgitated words. How can I take what Derek said and reword it so it sounds like me? I mean, your book, Anything You Want, 40 Lessons for a New Kind of Entrepreneur, is in my probably top three. I would give this to anybody starting a business. It's such a great book.
Oh, thank you. Well, yeah, you and I are definitely writing kindreds, because I felt the same thing whenever I was reading your stuff. It's like, this guy writes just like me.
I actually think you have a little bit more, there's almost this kind of like Zen minimalism style to your approach to both writing and entrepreneurship. You take these like very complicated concepts, like how should I sell my company, and you boil it down to two pages, and it's just great. Like, this is, people write entire books and give like TED Talks on this, and you're like, nah, do I care enough to sell it? Okay, I'm selling it.
Well, I guess I'm just, whittling out all those other moments and just sharing that, the key moment. So I got to ask you something.
Sure.
Did you ever read that Esquire magazine article about radical honesty?
Yes, because A.J. Jacobs, the author of that, has been on my podcast and we've spoken about it. And it's funny, I don't believe in radical honesty. Do you?
I think it's like nudity. I think it's, it's to be used in the right situation for the right people.
Exactly. Like, I believe in sincerity and transparency, but not in vomiting.
Right, exactly. So I was thinking that you, to me, sometimes feel like radical fault admitting. That even like when yesterday I realized I didn't know that you had done another podcast with Ramit. And right there at the beginning of the podcast, it's like you're so unprofessional, right? Like you're kind of saying, I should have had that before we spoke, but I forgot. Oh, well. And I so admire the way that it seems like you are almost finding ways to admit your faults at every turn. Like such a raw nerve that to me, it kind of seems like a brilliant way of getting the world, not getting the world, asking the world to love you in a way.
Well,
because it's like...
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, you're like, continue. So... showing your weaknesses, right? It's like, it feels like you are always showing the world your weaknesses. Well, and to me, the underlying message is, if you love all of this, you really love me.
Well, I think also people don't give themselves permission to admit their mistakes, their flaws. Everybody wants to be on a pedestal, or else they think people won't like them. And
right.
I'm sort of afraid of the pedestal. I think people want the reverse, and I want the reverse. I want people to know right off the bat that when they're dealing with me, bad things can happen. And one thing is, this is back to the radical honesty. I'll say bad things about myself all day long, but I'll never say bad things about others. So I'll never put anyone else down. I'll never be honest about. It's not that I'll be dishonest about it, but I'll never be transparent about other people's faults because it's not my business.
I like that. So back in the 90s, there used to be a great magazine called Musician Magazine. And they would include, I think like every few months, they would include a sampler CD along with a magazine of, here's 16 artists you've never heard before, one track each. And I used to love to get this CD and just put it on in the background while I was doing other things. And one day there was this one track that jumped out at me because the singer was singing... used to be I could go up to Barstow for the night, find some crossroad trucker, demonstrate his might. These days it seems like nowhere's far enough away. And her voice cracked. And then she goes, so I'm leaving Las Vegas today, leaving Las Vegas. And I remember when her voice cracked like that, I stopped what I was doing. And because I was just listening in the background. It's like, what? She left that in. That was fucking brilliant. And then it made me pick up the CD and who was that? And it turns out it was Sheryl Crow. She was an unknown artist at the time. And I so admired that decision to leave in that crack in her voice because it's like that little fault is what made me like her. I mean, there were whatever, 15 other artists on that CD that I will never remember, but I remember that one that left in that crack. And so you, to me, are kind of like that with your writing.
Well, it's interesting because this relates actually to a lot. It's funny you pick up on that with Sheryl Crow, and let's even say with my writing, because this is so much what your book is about. And it's interesting to what music is about, too, because people, and tell me if you disagree with this, and by the way, I just want to just get the bio out of the way. You started CD Baby, blah, blah, blah. It was one of the first websites to sell music. You sold it. It was great. You write books about entrepreneurship. I want to get back to what I was saying just a second ago, which is people often buy what they view as authenticity over what might be good music. So, for instance, the other 15 singers in that CD might have been good music, but what attracted you was authenticity. And you look, yeah. And I wonder if you agree with this. Like, take someone like Kurt Cobain. He was so authentic, say, with Nirvana. In particular, you look at the songs he covered from like the 30s and the 20s, like these really authentic musicians from way back. And then maybe he couldn't come to grips with authenticity as he became like a mega success, and this plagued him in some sense. And I wonder if you agree with that. And what is authenticity to you?
Ooh, big question.
Because your book and your style of entrepreneurship is so different. You were successful, wildly successful, but your style of entrepreneurship is so different from what, let's say, the typical, here's how you be a big success type of book, that it really strikes me as your own brand of authenticity. And that's what essentially gave you a happy ending and a happy life. A happy ending sounds bad, but you know what I mean.
Well, okay, let's see. Kurt Cobain first. Authenticity. Yeah, you're right. That's a good one. But the idea that he couldn't continue being authentic. I don't know, that suicide really pissed me off. If we believe the reasons around it, like I hate the fame and all that, because, you know, at any given point, he could cut his hair and apply for a job at a Burger King in Iowa City and nobody would ever believe he was Kurt Cobain. You know what I mean? Like, you can always disappear from fame.
But somehow nobody, you don't want to though. Like being, I don't think that would have been authentic to him either. Like he was aiming for the fame. It's almost like he didn't know what to do when he got there. And I'm not saying what he was saying or the reasons for his suicides were good or bad. I'm just wondering if somehow, he lost that drive for authenticity because he was past it.
Right. Wow.
And the same thing happens in, like, let's say rap music. Like, take, I don't know if you listen to rap, but like, take anybody, the difference between Drake and some up and coming, you know, rapper from the Bronx in New York. Like, people claim, even though his music might be good or bad, whatever your opinions are, people say he's not authentic. So a lot of people don't buy it for that reason, because he doesn't come out of, you know, the hood. And, you know, again, people judge music not necessarily on the quality of the music often, but on the authenticity of it. And it strikes me that your approach to entrepreneurship, as which approaches, which techniques you use, you determine more by its authenticity rather than whether it would drive customers.
You know, I was listening to the interview you did with Nassim Taleb. And
but one of our favorites. I noticed you have Anti-Fragile, one of your favorite books.
Oh, man. I love the way that guy thinks, because it so often comes down to these core values. It's almost like zooming out from the world a bit and finding some principle that stands above all these other details, and then focusing on that principle, and then deciding, well, let's just focus on this principle and extrapolate that and see where that principle goes.
Yes.
And I think that is what I often try to do with, well, with life, but of course then that comes out with entrepreneurship too, is like, okay, wait, why am I really doing any of this? What is this really about? Let me just zoom out and focus on this core principle. Now I'll extract from that principle. And then of course, when you extract from a core principle, it comes out being very different than all the usual bullshit that people do.
Like, give me an example of that I don't fully understand.
Okay, let me think.
Well, like, let's take in your business. You describe at one point you were telling investors you didn't want to get bigger, you wanted to get smaller. So, what was the core principle? What was the extraction from that?
Ah, okay. Then to me, that was like the core principle. There was, I like being happy, and one way I found to be happy is to have less responsibilities, for things to be lighthearted and fun, makes me happy. And so the idea of doing an IPO and suddenly, you know, being beholden to stockholders and all that, well, that's not fun. Why would I do that? It's like, well, you could make more money that way, but what's the point of making money? Is to be happy. And if it would make me unhappy to have so much responsibility, then I'd rather not make more money. I'd rather just focus on the happiness. Here's a better example, is focusing almost entirely on the customer and what's best for them. Then I think, well, are my customers wanting me to do an IPO? Like, when I get a bunch of, what is the suggestion box, you know, that classic, the wooden box with a little slat on the top and, you know, drop your suggestions in here.
Right. None of them would say, you must IPO now for my little CD. So I thought that was a great kind of, you have this metaphor throughout that, like, it was really interesting that, like, your customers don't really want you to expand. They'd actually want you to be, their ideal dream is for them to be your only customer.
Right. Exactly. And so, why would I do this then? I can't say I'm doing it for their sake. Am I doing it for my sake? No, I'd be happier with less responsibility. So I think that's what I mean about core principles, that kind of zooming out and saying, why am I doing any of this?
Yeah, so and let's get to that. So it seems like I'm gonna use one of these kind of like catchphrases to describe what you did and the theme of it. It's almost like you participated in what I'll call the favor economy. So it seems like a lot of your ideas, ranging from CD Baby to even what you're doing now with Now, is you start off with, I'm going to do a favor for somebody. And then if people respond to that favor and want more, then suddenly you say, I can scale this into a business or a platform or something that I want to spend more time on, because you personally like doing favors for people. So you created a buy now button for yourself. Then you did it for your CDs. Then you did it for a friend. Then more people started contacting you and you realize, I have a business. So this idea of verifying or validating that a business idea is good seems to be do a favor for someone, do it for yourself first so you learn how to do it, do it as a favor for someone else, see if more people ask, and voila, you have a business that cost you no money to create. Does that seem kind of accurate?
Yeah, that's a good description. I love it. That when, by doing favors for people, it implies that people are asking you to do those favors. And to me, the key is the asking. So bluntly put, I kind of think that you shouldn't start a business unless people are asking you to. You do the things that people are asking you to help them with. Those are the things you do. And you know, other than that, I guess I'm a reluctant businessman. I don't try to make businesses. I just kind of answer the calls for help when they come in and then see if I can, you know, systemize and turn that call for help into something I could help other people with.
And admittedly, that's one style. Like, nobody was asking Larry Page, hey, can you make the 8th failed search engine out there? Oh, right. Maybe they were asking, can you make a search engine with slightly better results than Alta Vista? I don't know. But right. or maybe he in his mind was asking that. So it helped him. So he figured maybe this will help others. And he saw by the usage and so on. But how does someone, let's say I always use this example. I'm sitting in my cubicle somewhere. I'm unhappy working for somebody else. How do I know what favors to do for people first, or what to do for myself that other people say, hey, can you do that for me? Because you say in the book, it took you 12 years of trial and error trying different things before, I hit upon doing something for myself that other people asked me to do for them. So this 12-year period was a long time.
Right. Okay, so I've been dying to ask you about this. The idea of choose yourself, that when I look back at my life and what was successful and what wasn't, it seems that whenever I was focused on me, like all my years making music, it's me up on stage singing my thoughts into a microphone, spotlights on me, I'm out there promoting me, and it's all about me. I did that for 15 years and it was hard. It was, you know, it just felt like always an uphill battle. I had some success, but for the most part, it was hard. But on the other hand, as soon as I turned my attention 100% to others, said, okay, forget me. How can I help you? And that was like the big idea behind CD Baby. When it was just completely putting myself into the service of others and just completely forgetting myself, I cease to exist, I am here solely for your service, then boom, that's where all the success seems to happen repeatedly in my life. So that's part of why I have a problem with the idea of, say, lifestyle design, where I hear too many people talk about, like, well, what kind of life do I want? I want to be in a hammock on a beach, and I only want to work from these hours. I want this, and I want that, and this is the kind of life that I want. Why isn't it working out for me? And I think, well, it's because you're focusing entirely on yourself. On the other hand, if you just forget all of this self-pleasuring and focus entirely on others, you might find that the world rewards you more.
Well, it's funny, because you mentioned earlier, you know, kind of the core values that you had, and one was you wanted to be happy. It seems like there's a gray area between coming up with your core values as opposed to helping other people achieve their core values.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of, you have to serve others within the limits of what you're able to sustainably do, right? You can't do something that makes you absolutely miserable. That's like the, you know, the engine that breaks down without oil. I like the metaphor that happiness is like the oil in the engine. You know, you need it for the engine to continue running. You can't do something you're unable to do. But within the realm of what you're able to sustainably do, if you focus entirely on others, that's where the world seems to reward you the most.
Yeah, that's really true. So you know, I imagine when you were performing music in 15 years, many things were getting in your way. One is venues had to like you, customers had to like your music, and distribution, you found out distribution companies had to like you. So some guy who just, I don't know, graduated high school or college had to say, okay, this is the guy we're going to distribute. And you depended on whether he had a good day or not that day, whether he was going right. to like you. And so the whole thing right. with Choose Yourself is, I don't want to have to hand over my destiny and my self-esteem to other people who I don't know. And so when people are coming to you in this kind of favor-based approach, you're not outsourcing your self-esteem to anybody.
Okay.
And so there it's kind of, you created this very, like, instead of relying on, oh, can Apple put me on the front page so I sell a lot of CDs, you've created CD Baby to sell your CDs. So you eliminated the outsourcing of your music self-esteem to other big, large companies.
Got it. Okay, that's a nice way of putting it.
You helped other people do that, and part of the thing was that guided your values throughout. Okay, you can't pay for placement. We're not going to have ads. You can't pay for any special treatment. Let me ask you this. Right now, we supposedly have this long tail where everybody could sell, 50 albums a month, no matter how bad you are or where you are in the long tail. But what's ended up happening in reality is that Amazon has actually, or Apple has created our choices for us. Like, oh, if you like this, you now might like this. And if you're not in their algorithm, you're actually further down on the long tail. Like, this kind of democracy of choice has created less choice in a weird way.
Yeah, because it's like, how are you going to find that artist number 1.5 million that's buried in there that Apple is not recommending to you?
Right. And so how does an artist now kind of overcome that?
Good question. It changes the techniques. Like, say, for example, this is just like one little hack, one little quirk, but it worked really well. Some of my best sellers at CD Baby were the ones that did one cover song on their album of a song that had never been covered before. So you can go to iTunes and use their search engine and do a little research for all of your favorite songs, right? And then when you find one that only has one version of it, right? Whatever it may be, I can't even think of an example right now because any example I would give would be one that already has lots of covers. But say you think back through the songs you love, you find one and the only search result is the original recording. Well, boom, that's a great song to go do a cover version of, because now in the future, you do a cover version of it, you get it up on iTunes, and anybody searching for that song in the future will only have two versions, the original and yours. And they'll say, wow, who is this one? And I found many times that gets people interested in the whole artist. So here's a specific example. Artist named Melissa Rebronia from Toronto did a cover version of, was it called Waterwall by Oasis? I'm your Waterwall. Wonderwall? Is that what that song was called?
I'm not sure.
So she did a cover version of that, and it was, like track number 9 on her full album of other songs that did not sound like that. But her whole album sold really well because that's how people found her in the mix. As they were searching for Wonderwall, found Oasis, and who's this? Melissa Rebronia. Oh, wow, let's check out her other track. So there are things like that. The rules change because that would not have been the case 20 years ago. You didn't walk into a physical record store and say, show me every album that has a version of the song Wonderwall on it.
But that's a very powerful approach. I always think, no matter whether you're a painter, a musician, a writer, or even a businessman, if you take what's already proven to resonate throughout the decades or the centuries or even the millennia, if you take that and do something slightly unique with it, you win. So for instance, whether or not you're a fan of Justin Bieber, and some people are and many people aren't, if Justin Bieber did a cover of John Lennon's Imagine, bam, that would win.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's the same type of approach. Like, if you take what resonates with time and, multiply it somehow or do it. Like, I do that with my writing. I'll find obscure stuff written like 1,000 years ago and take the ideas from it and sort of rewrite it in a modern context. And it works. Mm. Those are my most popular posts.
Hey, so let me ask you a question about giving advice. This has been on my mind a lot lately because, I did Tim Ferriss's podcast in mid-December, and I got a bunch of people contacting me after that, asking my advice on things. So for the last couple months, I've been giving a lot of advice. And I find that my advice is so tainted because it's a reaction against my surroundings, I think. Like, sometimes, somebody will ask me a question about what they should do with their career, and I give them my best advice by email and I hit send. And sometimes afterwards I wonder, like, why did I give that advice? Like, why did I say that? And I think it's often a reaction to what I feel is not said enough, right? So because...
What's an example?
I feel a lot of people are saying this, like, quit your job, quit your job, quit your job. And it almost seems to be the unanimous opinion is that everyone on earth should now quit their job. And so when people email me saying, I think I want to quit my job, then I feel it's almost like my duty to say, well, actually, maybe you shouldn't quit your job. Maybe there are reasons to keep your job. They say, well, I can't believe you're saying this. but I'm saying it because it feels like everybody else is saying the opposite, right? But then I remembered that, say, if I was in a different environment, say if I was working at whatever, HP, I was working at a big corporation and nobody was quitting their job and everybody thought that anybody who quits their job is crazy, well, then I'd probably be giving the advice to quit your job because it seems that everyone around me is saying, don't quit your job. So I'm giving voice to the lesser heard advice, right? So I wonder sometimes how much of your advice, like say if suddenly everyone in the world was taking your advice and everyone in the world was choosing themselves and making decisions like that, if it became ubiquitous, do you think you might be tempted to advise the opposite?
You know, that's a lot of people always ask me that. Like, let's say I say, never buy a home because it's a bad experience, whatever. Yeah. If everybody in the world followed this advice, nobody would be buying homes, the economy would collapse, and so on. So the first thing I always know is it's never the case that everyone is going to follow your advice.
Right.
So that will never happen. So I never think of it that way. The other thing is advice is autobiography. Like the best, no one wants somebody from a pedestal. They want to know, okay, I had this problem, here's how I solved it. So that's really your advice. It's all coming from your own advice is autobiography. So
here's the lottery numbers I played. Maybe these will work for you, kid.
Well, and guess who else did that? Buddha always said, here's what I do every morning. You can either try it or not. Like he didn't say, do this. He just said, this is what I do. And I'm not trying to be all Buddhist here. I'm just giving it as one example of something that's resonated through the millennia. He just said, this is simply what I do every day. You don't have to do it. You could be a king or a merchant or whatever, but this is what I do to become happy. And some people followed it and some people didn't. So I think qualifying things by saying, look, this is what I did. So for instance, take the job thing. I stayed at my job at HBO for 18 months after I started my business on the side. So even if there's a lot of reasons to quit a job, you have to do it carefully. And here's what I did. So that's what I usually do. But it's interesting though you bring that up. I know you answered 5,000 emails in a month. Like, why did you feel obligated to answer everybody? Was it stressful to do it?
No, I mean, well, it was a lot of work, but I wasn't complaining. It was fascinating. It's every writer's dream, right, to have your finger on the pulse of what people want to know. You know, so it was like, here's 5,000. Actually, in the end, it was, I think I got over 6,500 emails last time I counted from that show.
And what was the pulse? Like, what do you think? Because I find in those situations, there is a common question. And what was the theme? What is the zeitgeist right now from what you saw?
Oh, boy. I don't know if I can narrow it down to just one. The first thing that comes to mind is this idea of like, I want to quit my job and follow my dream, or I have this dream that I'm not following. Also, this, I don't know what my passion is. That's a huge one. Like, I haven't found my passion yet. I don't know what is my purpose, what is my calling. I don't know what my passion is. And I think that's a dangerous one because I believe that we've built up that word passion to be so deep. I kind of think like Romeo and Juliet. That sometimes those big, giant love stories can be really dangerous because they make you think like, okay, kids, this is what love looks like. Do you want to know what love is? Love is, you know, drinking potion and killing yourself and jumping off of balconies and stabbing others and all in the name of love. If it's nothing, if it's less than that, that's not really love because that's what love really looks like. You know, and so passion, I think, is this word that gets used like Romeo and Juliet. Like, I had a passion, man. I am passionate about my calling. I am passionate about, you know, malaria in Africa. This is a passion. I'm following my passion. And then, you know, some guy in Ohio is just sitting there playing his video games like, I don't really have a passion. But instead, if you just follow the little things that interest you, like you just notice on a day-to-day basis what you're drawn towards more. well, then you just keep doing that more and more. And you find that you get kind of driven by it eventually, that these things grow slowly, kind of like good relationships often grow slowly. You know, it doesn't have to be this boom, love at first sight, that it can be this thing that just grows and grows. But if you were thinking like, that doesn't look like passion, you know, that doesn't look like love, I didn't freak the fuck out the second we met, so it must not be love, it must not be passion, then you overlook some of the best things in life.
Let's stop to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Trying something new, I have great advertisers now supporting the show. I really wanted to do this because I don't think an idea like a podcast is good unless it's sustainable and supporting itself. And now I'm bringing on people to help me produce the show. I'm bringing on people to help me book great guests. I'm bringing on people and equipment to help improve the sound quality. So I'm very excited about this change. And one of the reasons why advertisers now love the James Altucher Show is that they know the show has amazing listeners. So I have a survey that I'd like you to take to help me learn more about our audience. Just go to podsurvey.com/James, J-A-M-E-S. The survey will only take you about 5 minutes. I'm going to ask you some questions about yourself and what you like to buy, but it's completely anonymous. Your answers help us find advertisers that are well-matched for you, your interests, and the show. When you're finished, you can enter a monthly drawing to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Even if you've taken a podcast listener survey before, I'd like to ask you to take ours and help support the show. Don't forget that you have a chance to win that $100 gift card. Once again, that's podsurvey.com/James. Thanks for helping us find the best advertisers so we can keep up the high quality of the show and even improve the quality. When I was an entrepreneur, when I was starting my first, second, third businesses, the worst thing in the world was keeping track of all the invoices, all the receipts. This was a super drag and I hated it. FreshBooks is simple and extremely fast cloud accounting software made for entrepreneurs and small business owners who want to take the work out of managing their paperwork. Join the over 5 million FreshBooks users who effortlessly create and send invoices in seconds, literally 30 seconds. No formula, no formatting, no fuss. And industry research has shown that FreshBooks users typically get paid faster than small business owners using other software. Snap photos of your receipts using your phone and watch FreshBooks manage your expenses for you. You can even set up FreshBooks to import expenses directly from your bank accounts, so next time you use your debit card for that meal or tank of gas, it's recorded instantly in FreshBooks. Man, I wish I had had this when I was running a business because this would have saved me so much time. I'm glad FreshBooks is a sponsor of this podcast. Mike McDermott, the entrepreneur and CEO of FreshBooks, founded the company in 2003 as a better way to manage the finances for his own design firm, then moved into his parents' basement for 3.5 years to get FreshBooks off the ground. You know what? I should get this guy on this podcast because it's a fascinating story. Right now, FreshBooks is offering a free 30-day trial to my listeners. Just go to freshbooks.com/James and enter James in the How Did You Hear About Us section.
It sounds like your career, if you look at it and slice and dice it in various ways, is very much like that in the sense that you had a theme rather than a passion. So your theme was music. You performed, you were an employee at Warner Chappell, and then finally, after a lot of trial and error, you learned programming, you started selling music online, and that turned into CD Baby, which finally, in this favor economy way, worked out. So it seems like still having a theme, like you say, noticing different things, but then what can you do within that larger core theme or value or whatever? That's kind of what people should be asking, perhaps.
Right. So, right. The I love that you brought that up. The theme. You can have a core theme in your life that often you don't notice until many years have passed and you notice that a lot of the things that have interested you the most have something in common. So check this out. I'm kind of changing the subject, but kind of...
Go for it.
Pivoting on that point. That I was working with this consultant coach dude once that he wanted to get to what was my core value. And he said, well... I said something about programming. He said, well, why do you like that? And I said, well, because of this. And he said, well, why is that important to you? I said, because of this. And he said, okay, well, then why is that important to you? And he kept drilling down. It was kind of like the five whys, but this version that was trying to get to, like, why is that important to you? What's the core value of that? Why does that matter to you? And so he got down to what was supposed to be the final value, but to me it came down to two, that my two most important values were learning and creating. And he said, okay, now of those two, which one is more important to you ultimately? I was like, well, no, you can't reduce it any farther. He's like, no, you have to figure out which one of those two is more important to you. Is it ultimately about the learning or ultimately about the creating? I thought about it for a bit and I said, you know what? This is a fault of the English language. Because, you know, sometimes there in other languages, there are words that take a whole paragraph to say in English, but, you know, in Portuguese, they may have a word, is it surare or something like that, that takes a whole paragraph to explain it in English. But in Portuguese, that's just one word. And I thought, you can't say that I haven't figured out my core value, because I have. My core value is learning for the sake of creating, for the sake of learning, for the sake of creating. It's just that we don't have a single word for that. But to me, that is one core theme, is that my whole life, I love learning things for the sake of creating things, which is for the sake of learning things, which then is for the sake of creating things. Like, that loop is a thing to me that should be one word. That's my theme.
So it's interesting. Let me take that for a second, because a lot of people love to create. There's two reasons maybe someone loves to create, because there's that instant feeling of like, ah, and you mentioned this, how do you grade yourself? You have a section on that in your book. And so some people might grade themselves in two ways when they create. One is that feeling of, ah, I know this is good and I feel good about it, so now I'm going to release this into the world or not, and then I'm going to move on to the next thing I create. Other people might create because they want other people to like what they created. So, and there's a little bit more self-interest in that, where other people have to like it in order for me to feel validated about what I created. So there could be an additional why there, which is, why do you love to create?
So hypothetically, those examples you just gave, imagine somebody, I think of this as AC/DC. AC/DC has been writing the same song since the 70s. Every time a new AC/DC album comes out, you know it is going to sound pretty much exactly like the ones they've been putting out since 1975. You know, so that is creating, 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 creating. They have written hundreds and hundreds of songs, dozens of albums, but I wouldn't say that hardly any of those past the first two were a real learning experience. So that to me is the poster child for creating without learning. And then learning without creating to me are like those people that learn a bunch of stuff but never do anything with it, right? And there are plenty of examples of that. So what you just said, I like those examples you gave of you create because it's something that makes you happy once it's done. Like, ah, look, I made this great painting that's just the way I want it to be, and you want the feedback from the world. Creating for the sake of learning something, or using your creating as a learning process, can be an additional need that doesn't replace those other ones. It's, yes, I also want the world's feedback and all that stuff, all these other reasons we create, but to me it also needs to have some element of personal growth and learning in the sake of creating.
You know, it's funny because I deal with this with my own writing. I see what people liked so much in 2010 and 2011, and sometimes I feel this urge, okay, I have to write again a post like that.
Right,
you know, as opposed to finding like another way to reinvent myself or reinvent the writing or do something new. Like how do you, you've clearly reinvented yourself several times. Like you were, you focused on your being a musician and music, which I'm sure you still do, but you did it 100% for a while. Then you focus on CD Baby 100% for a decade. How do you continue to reinvent yourself and reinvent this, I'm going to call it passion, but reinvent this passion you have for music and creation?
Okay. I'm going to tell you something I think I've never talked about publicly, that, well, for one, this isn't the thing yet. We'll get to that. That I love that we have role models, public role models. To me, some music legends have been great role models in how they shaped their career path. And specifically, I'm thinking of Bob Dylan, Miles Davis, and let's say David Bowie, where Bob Dylan, some of you know, maybe not all of you know, did this thing where up until, I forget what year it was, like 1965, he was a very famous folk art, like the most famous folk artist, but folk was kind of more in a purist sense. Like it was folk as opposed to rock in the time. So it's like just the guy with his guitar, all acoustic, man, being completely real because it's acoustic, not electric. And so then he went on stage at the Newport Folk Festival. He was the headliner and he was as big as can be and the curtains open and he steps out with a rock band and a Stratocaster in his hand and jaws dropped and somebody in the crowd yells, Judas! And it was just such blasphemy. Bob Dylan is going electric.
I didn't know this story.
You don't? Oh, man, sorry. Okay, so I guess, just, yeah, as a musician, it's just like, you know, these are like the tales we grow up with. Everybody knows this story if you're a musician. So to me, this was like, wow, what a bold move he made is to give up on this thing that he had created because he said he felt that he had painted himself into a corner, that he needed to break expectations to continue to grow creatively, right? So Miles Davis did a very similar thing. Again, he was known as this bebop trumpet player that was played with Charlie Parker and so everybody knew him as this bebop trumpet jazz musician. And then he started doing albums like, what is it called? Was So What? Kind of Blue, which was shocking at first in the fact that it had like almost no chords. The whole thing is just in D. The bridge goes up to E flat and then back to D again. It was like the opposite of everything jazz was about at the time, where it was all about these quick jazz changes and changes in chords every two beats. And for him to go completely against that and then later do things like, you know, play with an electric trumpet and all that, again, it was blowing off expectations or particularly knowing he was going to anger people, but knowing that this was something that was necessary for him to grow creatively. It's like, I've been there, I've done that. Now it's time to force myself to change. And then, of course, the David Bowie examples where he'll just kind of, he'll be something for a few years and go completely into that persona for a few years and then change persona. It's just like a creative exercise. So these to me were, you know, these stories were legend and they shape the way I think about things, that you do something for a while and once you feel that you've hit the... you finished your creative expression of that idea, then it's almost your duty to force yourself to change.
I agree with that, and I want to pose one counterexample. And so this is a great guy, so it's not a bad counterexample. Scott Adams, who makes the Dilbert cartoon, he's been doing Dilbert for 25 years or more, and I asked him, why are you still doing Dilbert? You've clearly achieved financial success. It wasn't necessarily... this passion from youth that you had to like draw this cartoon about a guy in a cubicle. You know, you've done it. It's beautiful. You've created a whole work of a body of art here. And he mentioned that he has a whole machine to sustain now. Like a lot of people depend on this cartoon coming out every day. So what do you do if you're kind of tied to the responsibility of something?
Oh, you just say, sorry, I wish you the best. I would have done it the Bloom County way, where it's like he did Bloom County was huge, I guess, 20 years ago.
Yeah, breathed.
And just he did it and did it and did it until he felt like, okay, I've done what I wanted to do. Or what was it, Calvin and Hobbes too, right? Like just, I hit my point. I'm good with that. And sorry, I know that this is going to put some people out of work, but I know you're going to find other jobs. And just creatively, I need to make a change now. So
And then there's the other example, which is, and I'm trying, and this is where it's hard to find an example, but there's the fear when you reinvent that, oh my gosh, I'm going to become a one-hit wonder.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So thank you for prompting me to the thing I don't think I've ever spoken about publicly is when I sold CD Baby in 2008, it was actually a really dark time for me. You can read between the lines in my book, and I toned it down because it was one of those things that I felt like, this is just, I'm being a little too personal here. I'm trying to just keep focused on what's useful to others to read, and now I'm getting a little bit into a sob story. So I had like a couple chapters that I cut out because they were a little too me. But it was a really hard time for me. It was basically like CD Baby kind of ended with a mutiny, right? Like this company that I started and all these people that I hired, just something went kind of fucky in the internal culture. And it's like they were kind of making me walk the plank. And it was just sad and just made me want to hide from the world like forever. Like, dude, I was seriously looking into how to legally change my name and change my citizenship and move to some other part of the world and just disappear. Like I would tell my family and two or three dear friends where I was, but otherwise I just wanted to start anew with a whole new life and have nothing to do with the other one because I just wanted to hide. I hated how much responsibility I had with CD Baby, and I just wanted to just slough off the whole world, right? And I stayed in that mindset for about a year, of really planning on changing my name, dropping off of the grid entirely, right? I was reading, you can find a couple books out there called How to Disappear. I read them.
I've read that book too. That book actually has beaten me out on Amazon occasionally. Like sometimes they promote it again and it's like pops up onto the Wall Street Journal bestseller list.
Great title.
Yeah.
So it was on a plane ride to New York. I was going out to New York for a friend's wedding and I was reading the book called 48 Laws of Power, I think. And it was talking about accepting public fame or recognition as its responsibility, like take on the role of public attention. And I thought about this and I thought, yeah, it is kind of the chicken shit thing to do, to run away and hide and change my name and go, plug my ears, shove out the world, like I'm going to disappear. And I was like, I could probably step up to the responsibility. I can man up to what I've created and step into the spotlight and do something worthy there. And okay, so here's the key point, is that for a year or so, I had felt completely unmotivated. Like every day, I kind of had no reason to wake up. I had millions of dollars in the bank. I had absolute freedom. I wasn't even in a relationship at the time. Just on any given point, I could just be anywhere, do anything. I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to be anywhere. It was like, there is such a thing as too much freedom. And I had it in that moment. Or for this whole year, this strange, lethargic, exploratory year with no drive. And then on that plane ride, I had this idea. I was like, I think I want to be a TED speaker, or like not just a TED, that's just a kind of a symbol to me, but I want to be like a writer, speaker, thinker kind of guy. Because at that time, as you prompted, I felt that I was a one-trick pony, that like my gravestone was going to say, here lies Derek Sivers, he made CD Baby, not much since. that's how it felt, like I had peaked, right? And this was the first idea I had that felt like it went beyond that peak. Like if I could really be like a writer, speaker, thinker kind of guy where TED invites me to speak on stage and get into that world instead of just my world of musicians, like, wow, that's kind of inspiring. And for the first time, I felt inspired to action. Like now I had a worthy goal that made me jump into action. And I love that definition of like a good goal is one that actually changes your actions in the moment. Like right now, goals are not about the future. Goals are about changing the present moment, changing your present actions. So suddenly I was inspired as hell to like, I started writing like 6 to 8 hours a day and working on my thoughts and chiseling them down to make them surprising and cutting and succinct so I could make this point in 4 paragraphs, short enough that I knew everybody would read it and forward it to their friends and not procrastinate to read it. And I put so much work into this, and then, yeah, within 9 months, I was speaking at the main stage TED in front of Bill Gates and Larry Page and all these intimidating people, and then I did it 3 times, and then people now know me more from TED and come up to me and say, so what did you do before TED? And like, well, I had this little music store. You know, you probably haven't heard of it. But yeah, that was my reinvention of 2010. And
it's interesting because, again, I think what separates your talks and your book out from anything else is this authenticity about what it's really like to be an entrepreneur, what it was really like for you to be an entrepreneur, and you kind of, like you said, whittled it down to what your core values were and how you implemented them. And I guess I wonder, I feel so inauthentic at times, even though I try to be authentic, and people think of me as authentic, but it's very difficult, and it doesn't seem like it was that difficult for you. Like, how does somebody sort of reach inside and figure out their authenticity? Is it this kind of drilling down on the why, or what is it?
Wait, I'm sorry. How are you? I got to hear about you for a second. How are you being inauthentic?
I sometimes feel like a people pleaser. Like, I want to be entertaining. I want this podcast to be entertaining. I want my writing to be entertaining. So I'm trying to figure out that balance between pleasing others and doing something artistic. And sometimes I don't quite know where the line is. But I feel like with your business and with your book, you're saying things exactly and doing things exactly how you wanted to do them. And I think that's hard to know. There's so many layers of, oh my gosh, when I'm 16 years old, this girl didn't like me and I had to wear all these masks to get someone to like me. And 30 years later, I still feel that way.
Interesting. Well, some of that I think is just being considerate, right? That you could, at any given moment, you could hit record on your mic and you could say, you know, hey, everybody, welcome to the show. Instead of having a guest today, I'm just going to sit here for an hour and a half and just talk about whatever's on my mind today. And you could go there with no script and it would be completely authentic, but it would be completely indulgent and completely boring to others. So right. I think it's actually considerate to shape your message in such a way, to edit yourself first. Not being fake, but just being considerate, right? So for example, a few times people have asked my advice on giving TED Talks, and here it is. Here's my advice in 5 seconds, is to just cut out everything that isn't surprising. Because
I love that.
People watch TED Talks in order to learn something. And if they're not surprised, they're not learning, right? Like if you're just telling them, well, this, and I grew up here, and I got this story, that you haven't surprised them. You haven't made their eyebrows go up, right? So they haven't really learned anything. So instead, if you look at whatever message you want to give, whatever story you want to tell, and then just erase every single line of it that isn't surprising. And what you're left with is a short, succinct, surprising thing that somebody can actually learn from. So that's why my book is only 88 pages. It's because, you know, at every paragraph, I cut out everything that I felt other people say that's been heard before that isn't surprising. And I just focused only on, you know, the sentences, the paragraphs that were actually surprising.
Well, I think you do that for your business and your book as well. So for instance, when advertisers came to you and said, hey, you got the traffic, we'd love to advertise, and you said no, that's a surprising response. 100% of other 99.9% of other businesses would say, sure, let's flip the switch on advertising.
Well, that to me is like a bigger issue of like, why would you, it's like letting somebody put a Coke machine in the monastery. Like, what's important to you in life? Like, really? Is it all down to money? Like, you just want money at all costs? Like, why would you let somebody litter up your thing? I still kind of, part of the reason I hardly ever listen to Tim Ferriss's podcast is because by default, my little audio player that's on my phone, it doesn't have a fast forward button for some reason. I think it's because it's the one that's built right into Firefox or whatever. It doesn't have fast forward. And a couple times I try to listen to his podcast, it's like, fucking 6 minutes of goddamn fucking ads up front. Tim, why are you doing this? And I don't make it past the 6 minutes. I'm like, I just can't sit here and listen to shilling for 6 minutes. And so I don't.
I like how you put it though, the Coke machine in the monastery. So again, it's like fueled, like what you do is fueled with authenticity, just like a monastery is supposed to be, you know, as authentic as possible to belief and, you know, being spiritual and so on, whether it is or isn't, I don't know, but that's the idea. And of course, you're not going to put a Coke machine in a monastery. That wouldn't be authentic to it. And it's still, to me, boils down to authenticity in everything you do. And I think that's a big theme of your book, well, even though it's not explicitly stated. Which brings me to the question, why, given that this is, you know, sort of advice or lessons for a new kind of entrepreneur, which is the subtitle, why did you leave out the chapters that made you cry? Because you're driving people to the point where you cried.
I know, it was very un-Altucher of me, wasn't it? I just think I looked at it and it felt like this is just me being, this isn't useful to anybody else. This was my one weird situation. I don't think this is universal. This was like a really weird thing that happened where, because of the unique situation I had, where I had like a bunch, I had 85 people, all between the ages of 20 and 26, basically. And it just created this weird little perfect storm of this anti-pattern of culture. And that was just kind of, I didn't think that there was a universal lesson in there so much, or I hadn't extracted a universal lesson from that other than, you know, a rotten apple really does spoil the barrel. That when I looked back at what made the culture so bad there, in the end, it was like this beautiful culture for 8 years. It was a great place to work. And then just something changed and it turned awful. And when I look back, it really was just a couple rotten apples, like just a couple people that spoiled the barrel.
It's funny because I call that, so I had a similar situation in a business I started, and I call that the virus. And as soon as you see the virus appear, you have to immediately eliminate it, because otherwise it spreads in the stairwells, it spreads in the lunches or the coffees, and then everybody has the virus and you can't kill yourself. You're too late. So you did summarize this in the chapter title, which is delegate but don't abdicate.
Right. I found a very nice diplomatic way to just kind of, I hinted at that. I didn't dive into it. Didn't dive into the woe is me thing too much. But you know what's kind of sweet, by the way? A few years after the book came out, one of the guys that worked for me in customer service, named Dan, he's now a guitar teacher in Idaho, and he's actually opened up his own music shop where he's got a couple people working for him. And I hadn't heard from him in years, I hadn't heard from anybody. You know, I sold the company in 2008 and it was kind of like, you know, sorry, I'm sticking my middle finger in the air right now. It's like, fuck you guys, I'm never speaking to you again. And they never spoke to me again. I never spoke to them again. That was just, it was bad blood at the end. And so here I get this email from Dan years later saying, hey, I don't know if you remember me. I used to work for you at CD Baby. Well, now I'm this guitar teacher and I have a few people working for me. And he said, suddenly I realized how hard it is to be a boss and be a manager, and it's really hard, and they try to like blame me for all of their problems in life. And he said, it made me realize we really did that to you, didn't we? He said, I'm so sorry. He said, I don't know what came over us. I don't know why all of a sudden we just decided you were the bad guy. He said, there was a weird kind of mom mentality that happened at the time that I didn't even notice it at the time. But now that I've got employees myself, he said, I just want to say I'm sorry. I don't know why we treated you like that. And I was like, aww.
That's great that you got that email, because I think a greater than 1% response from your ex-employees is, you know, 1,000% more than anyone else gets. So that's great
really
that
nice
he recognized
him.
That. You know, you said another thing very interesting, and I've been dealing with this a little bit. When people are either your customers or your employees, they feel very strongly that they know you and that you kind of should do or conform to some behavior that they expect. And you have this chapter about excluding people, and it's a very healthy reminder that you can't, you know, there's that saying, you know, if you try to please everyone, you end up pleasing nobody. If you try to please everybody all the time, you end up pleasing nobody all of the time or none of the time, or I don't know, some quote like that.
give a man a fish and he'll...
Something is fed.
Shame on you.
Right. So I think it's a very healthy reminder in building a business that you're not going to be a monopoly of the world, you know, and of every constituency of your business. You can't do that. Even if your job is to please the people you want to please, you just can't do it. There's going to be this vocal minority that hates you, and your job then is to exclude them from what you do.
Yeah. It's. I think you've talked about this before, this idea that, you know, on your blog, you might get 99 nice comments and then you get one negative one, and it's human nature to look at that one and go, hey, hey, what the hell? Why isn't every single person happy? And you focus so much on the one person that's not happy with what you do. But yeah, it's you find that you can, well, again, music is a good role model. Music that tries to please everybody is what? It's elevator music, right? And the way that you make great music is by doing something that somebody's going to hate. You take a chance, you push it to some new extreme. You say something in a way that some people might find offensive, but a few will find extremely refreshing and honest and real.
So, and I bet one of the questions that you got in among these 6,500 questions that you've gotten in this past month or so is, I'm afraid to take that chance of being myself, being authentic, saying what I really feel because of, you know, maybe a boss won't like me or my colleagues won't like me or a future employer won't like me or future customers won't like me. That's a big fear for people.
Okay, now I know I've never said this publicly before. By the way, I meant to tell you this when we first said hello. This is the last interview I'm going to do for a long time. In fact, when I did, so my book called Anything You Want was re-released in August. And so I did a whole ton of interviews from August to December. And then I did Tim Ferriss's in December, and I said, that's it, no more. That was exhausting. I am done. And I told my assistant, that's it, no more interviews. And she said, you want me to say no to everybody? I said, yeah, everybody. I said, wait, except James Altucher.
That's funny.
If I hear from him, absolutely, I want to do that one. And then like a week later, you emailed. I was like, aw.
That's excellent. The timing was
right.
That's
destiny. So this is for real this time. This is like my last interview for a long time. And so here's a very embarrassing story. Like this is one of those classic like Altucher kind of things. Like I shouldn't be saying this, but I'm about to.
These are the only stories.
That there was this girl I knew once that was an aspiring entrepreneur, very ambitious, but not yet so successful. And she was a good friend of mine, but also really looked up to me. And she said, like, I don't know, she just noticed that nothing bothers me, right? Like, I never get mad. I never get too upset. And she's like, how can I be as carefree as you? Like, nothing bothers you. How do you do that? How do you just let everything roll off your back? And I thought about it for a bit.
And you started crying.
Right. I thought about it for a bit, and I was like, well, first you get $1 million.
That helps.
She just thought that was the funniest thing. But like, that was the real answer. And we're not supposed to say that. And again, maybe I'm giving this contrarian advice because I feel that I'm surrounded by people that say that money doesn't matter. Or is like, you know, okay, maybe if I was working on Wall Street, I might be saying money doesn't matter. But in my world, I'm surrounded by people that say that money doesn't matter. And so I feel my contrarian need to say, actually, it really helps. And that's a big, I feel it's like a big reason I feel so comfortable in not needing to please others, is this feeling of like, yeah, there's a reason they call it FU money, right? It's like, I don't need anybody. I don't need anything from anyone. And I don't need you. And I don't know, that's a big part of it. I highly recommend, if you were somebody that was thinking of perhaps getting rich and not sure whether you should or not, I highly recommend it.
Well, and the thing is, this really is like a guidebook. Again, I'm going to get back to the beginning, which is it took you 12 years of testing different ideas, doing things for yourself, figuring out the right favor you could do for yourself that other people would then ask for that then scaled into a business. And that's how, that really is the way to make $1 million. This is if you do 1 million favors and you do it in a way that's scalable, then bam, you have it.
Right. And you're right. Exactly. And they're different methods. I think that, you know, Ramit Sethi and all the kind of like, I will teach you to be rich and all the things that are out there teaching you how to make a lot of money, most of them are correct. If you actually follow through, there was, who's this guy? Oh my God, why am I forgetting his name right now? A friend of mine, I can't remember his name right now. He was the president of, Ian Rogers, president of Top Spin, said that there was this fitness book that LL Cool J put out years ago. It was like the LL Cool J.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
Guide to Fitness. And Ian Rogers actually went through the whole book and actually followed to the letter and did absolutely everything he said to do and ate exactly what he was supposed to eat. And then one day later, like, met LL Cool J and he said, I actually did your book. And like, LL was like, I have never met somebody that actually did my book before. He said, lots of people read it. They do it half-assed. They do a little bit of it. They tell me, oh, good book, man. I really want to do that someday. He said, you really did it? You really did everything in it? He said, to the letter. He said, man, like, no wonder you're in good shape. And
so it worked.
I think that about a lot of those programs that are out there that say, like, if you do this, you will make a lot of money. And I'll bet that most of them work if you actually do it, you know, instead of just think that you should and mean to get around to it someday. But anyway, sorry, I think that was a tangent on something else we were talking about.
No, but I think that's true. And I think for you, it was the being authentic to what you were interested in, being authentic to being happy, but also kind of sticking to this core idea. You mentioned it throughout the book, which is that your customers are always going to come first before any expansion, before any standard ideas of how to make a business bigger, before raising money, before an IPO. You stuck to this authentic value that was important to you, which is that you wanted to sell music and you wanted in as a conflict-free as possible way for other musicians to sell music. And I think that was what was scalable, as opposed to, yeah, let's get advertising, let's, you know, sign up with, you know, Universal or whoever, and you do these things that would cut corners for you.
Well, I guess it often helps to say, to start a sentence with, in a perfect world, ... you know, how would it look? So I think that's where a lot of those things came from. It's like, well, in a perfect world, how would this work? Like, of course, there would be no advertising. In a perfect world, there would be no paid placement. So anybody had just as much of a shot to be on the front page as anybody else. So you would not be allowed to buy up the front page. In a perfect world, I'd get paid every week. In a perfect world, I'd know the full name and address of everybody who buys my music. In a perfect world. So, you know, even though I'm saying all of this stuff and acting like I'm taking credit for it, you got to admit that I could have just been some guy with all of these philosophies and some store that didn't go well. A huge reason it got successful, it was just the damn luck of right place at the right time. It was late 1997, beginning of 1998, and there were no other online music stores at the time. And so my little rinky-dink thing that was ugly and amateurish looking just... I was the guy on the surfboard when the huge wave came in, you know? I just rode the wave. It was amazing timing. I couldn't have done it a year before or a year later.
Well, and so now, coming towards the end of your book here, how do you grade yourself now?
To me, it's how much I create. It's that thing that I said earlier about learning for the sake of creating, for the sake of learning, for the sake of creating. Like, ultimately, the measurable thing is how much I'm creating, maybe because I won't let myself just keep creating without learning something. So to me, I need to measure my output for my own personal measure of success. I can't imagine just learning things without using what I'm learning to create.
So what are you working on now? When's the next book?
I might do another book.
I love this book so much. You're like the Zen master of like entrepreneurship writing. But maybe there's other things you could be the Zen master of.
Well, you know what's funny? Did you read Smart Cuts by Shane Snow?
I've read it. Shane's been on the pod. The second I read it, by the way, it was like 6 a.m. I wrote Shane and said, you got to come on my podcast today.
Oh, good. That book punched me in the gut. I loved that book. Hey, wait, you know what else I've been meaning to ask you forever? Was it Power of No or Choose Yourself? In one of your books, you said something like, pick a subject that you would read 100 books on that subject, right?
Yeah, so I say, go into the bookstore, which section will you read the entire section of? And that's what that could help you find out what you're interested in.
So have you actually read 100 books on a single subject?
Oh, yeah. I've read like... 1,000 books on a single subject.
Come on, no exaggeration. Really, 1,000 books?
Yeah. Like, for instance, I love games. So I've read at least 1,000 books on chess, for instance.
Really?
Yeah.
1,000? You're not exaggerating. You're not like, okay, you're not going to look back, okay, well, it's actually 180, but it felt like 1,000.
No. Ever since I was 18, I'm 48 now. I read, you know, 100 books a year on chess, maybe more.
Wow. All right.
So that's an example. Now, I can't do that professionally, but perhaps there's other ways to act professionally. You can program a chess computer, or you can write books yourself, or you could organize tournaments or whatever. I don't know. I read probably several hundred books on poker as well.
All right. Well, I will just leave my jaw over there on the ground, and I'll try to keep talking.
I'm sure you've read or gone through 100 books on music.
No.
What about books of the word escapes me, and it's the most common word in the world. You know where they. No, where they have the notes. Pages where they have notes.
Oh, sheet music. Right?
Sheet music, yeah.
Well, okay. Every book I've read since 2007 is up on my website. If your listeners, this is something I was doing for myself privately and then realized there's no reason to keep this private on my hard drive. I should share this with the world. So every time I read a book, if it's a paper book, I read it with a pen in my hand, underlining the sentences I like. And then I would open up a raw text file afterwards, and I would type in every sentence I liked from that book so that I could just freely give the book away or just not worry about the book ever again and know that I had saved in a nice searchable format, just plain text file, all the best bits I loved from that book, because I really wanted to get them into my soul. You know, I wanted to memorize what I had learned. And now the Kindle makes that even easier. So I put them up on my site at sivers.org/book.
I highly recommend that page, by the way. I've read most of the books on that page. You definitely have a passion for entrepreneurship and high concept thinking, like Anti-Fragile and so on.
Yeah.
So I think it's a great list of books.
Okay, so Shane Snow, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this. One of his points that punched me in the gut in the middle of that book, it was a great book all around, but there was one point that just, it was a little toss-away sentence that he said something like, the business you're in might not be the business you think you're in. You need to look at what people are really responding to. And he used the example, I think, of Flickr, I think it was, that it started out as something else, but then they noticed that everybody was using their engine to share photos, and they realized, I think we're actually in a different business than we thought we were in. So when I read that sentence, I had to kind of like stop and put the book down and think for a while that I've been calling myself a programmer for the longest time. Like when people say, what do you do? I say, I'm a programmer. It's actually part of my way of just shutting down the conversation so I don't have to get into the what do I do kind of thing. If you say programmer, right, most people just go, oh.
Right.
You know. And if they can actually talk programming, well, then I do actually want to talk to them. But when I think about that, nobody is responding to my programming. Nobody cares about the stuff. Even with CD Baby, it's like, yes, I did all of the programming all myself for CD Baby, but it was just some barely functional e-commerce store. It was actually all of the words around it. It was all of my talking that I was doing in my newsletters and blog posts and speaking at conferences. Those were the reasons that people really signed up to CD Baby, was because of all the talking I was doing around it. It's like, wow, actually, what people really respond to is my writing. So, wow, what if I'm actually a writer? I'd never thought about that before. I'd always just considered that writing was just some little thing I did on the side to share what I'd learned. But I'm really a programmer, but I think I might need to flip that. I think maybe I'm really a writer, and programming is something I enjoy tinkering with, the way that somebody enjoys tinkering with their car, you know, the old Corvette in the driveway idea, right? So, but then my thinking was flipped around this twice, because I don't earn any money writing. I mean, maybe I could if I really tried, but my only income comes from investing. So it's like, well, does that mean I'm really an investor that likes writing? I was like, I don't know. I'm curious what your thoughts on do you define yourself based on what gets the biggest response, or where your money is coming from, or just what you like doing the most?
I totally define it on what I like doing the most, with the idea that I also have to think of what feeds me and my family. But the writing is what I love. Like you asked, what's a 100 or 1,000 books that I've read. I've certainly read 1,000 good novels or collections of short stories in order to improve my writing. This is the thing I think about all day long and care about the most.
Mm.
I used to go on, I was like you, I had something, like you had CD Baby. I used to go on and I made financial websites. I used to go on CNBC and talk about stocks and finance. But I realized almost everybody on these shows is just talking BS. And I just wanted to And here I am, you know, going through constantly anxiety about money and all these things, despite being a so-called, you know, expert like everyone else on CNBC about money. So I just wanted to write the truth and be, and this is where I was authentic, and I wanted to write it well through stories. That's how I got the greatest satisfaction for myself. Like you said, though, before, it helps to be doing things that have made you money and make you money, and investing certainly helps that. But I never think about my investments. That's where I've delegated and I've abdicated. I hate right. thinking about it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't know that about you. I thought it was still kind of a side passion of yours, because you still talk about it a lot.
I talk about it because I know a lot about it. Okay. And so I feel like bad when other people make mistakes that way. And I could just say from my experience, oh, look, here's when I tried to raise money from Bernie Madoff. So, you know, right. that's a story, but it's a story where I made a potential mistake. And, you know, I use it to help other people not make mistakes through storytelling.
Interesting. Yeah, I can relate. The entrepreneur thing, or even, let's just say, talking about CD Baby, I personally wish I never had to talk about it ever again. I mean, part of the reason I put out that book was to kind of close the chapter on that phase of my life and say, okay, here's all the lessons I learned from that. I'm done. And so it's kind of funny when years later, people will invite me to speak at a conference and I'll say yes. And I'll think that I get to just get up there and talk about whatever I want. And then after I've said yes and they've put me on the program, they say, really, we want you to talk about how you you built and grew and sold CD Baby. And I think, oh, fuck, really? And I think, okay, well, that is what the crowd wants. Okay, I'll do it one more time.
So. But entrepreneurship is so, people want the XYZ technique. But the reality is, and I think you kind of refer to this in your book in a lot of ways, it's very personal and very psychological how to build a business. Like, it's difficult. And people don't realize it's not about where you put the Facebook ad. It's about where you change yourself in order to deal with all these psychological problems that come up.
I thought you were going to make that into a Hollywood line there. It's not about where you put the Facebook ad. It's about where you put your heart.
Maybe I almost said that. Thank God I did.
I love that as a songwriter. I think actually, but you know, so I spent 15 years of my life as a songwriter, and I still think it shapes the way that I think about words. You know, think of the kind of the symmetry of words. And
well, you said it earlier. You were telling me a story, and you started off with, there was a girl I once knew, and that's totally the beginning of like a song.
What was it? Kevin Kelly once gave a talk where he said, we should focus on making a living, not on making something huge or something like that. And I emailed him afterwards. I was like, Kevin, you missed the line. It's about making a living, not making a killing. And he goes, oh, thank you. That's awesome. I want to use that.
Oh, my God. That's great.
Like, of course. It's like, look, I'm always looking for those little symmetry of words. It's just the songwriter in me still. Okay, anyway.
Well, I want to close with this, because this is the line that I've inadvertently stolen from you. And I only know this by accident because people keep retweeting me saying it. But it's actually, just want to give you full credit for it, which is the quote, if it's not a hell yeah, then it's a no. Like,
yeah.
I see it all the time. I'm tweeted as saying it, but it's totally you. And I don't know how I got to say it, but it's your saying.
I still, you know, and I'll give full credit. My songwriter friend, Amber Rubarth, came up with that one day when I was wrestling with a decision on whether to go off to this conference in Australia. I was living in Union Square in New York City, and I had agreed to, or told a friend that I'd go with her to a conference in Australia. Once it actually came close, I was like, oh God, I don't know. And I was describing my decision-making process to her, and she said, it sounds like you're not trying to decide between yes and no. To you, it really comes down to either fuck yeah or no. I said, yes, that's it. It's either fuck yeah or no. So there's my full credit is Amber Rubarth came up with that. And so I wrote it up on my blog as fuck yeah or no. And then at the last minute, I decided to make it more PG-13 and I changed the fuck to a hell. So yeah, hell yeah or no. And you know what's nice, man, is that one of the nice things about sharing your philosophies publicly and writing things on your blog all the time is that your friends echo your own philosophies back at you. So I'm not kidding. Just yesterday, I was trying to make a pretty big decision in life. And I called a friend to ask her thoughts. And she said, well, she listened to me and said, well, A smart guy I knew once said something called a hell yeah or no. And I think you need to be taking that advice right now. It's like, oh my God, you're right.
Wait, what was the big decision? Can you tell us? Just a little.
It was, I have, as of this minute, a business in Belgium that I started in Belgium because it made me a legal resident of Belgium, which then in 5 years leads to citizenship. And I was doing it, but then that for the last 2 years, I've had this wood egg business running in Belgium, but I hate it. The business just doesn't need to be alive anymore. It's nothing the public needs. I don't believe in forcing something on people, and I believe in, you know, shutting it down if people don't want it. And yet I was keeping it active just to kind of keep the Belgium government happy. And I was asking a friend's advice, and she said, like, yeah, you're giving me a bunch of reasons why you could and should keep it active, but I can tell you're not feeling hell yeah about it. And just the fact that this thing is sitting in your life, taking up any mental space, it's you're violating your fuck yeah or no rule. I said, oh yeah, that was the decision moment. Like, once she said that, I was like, that's it. That's really what it comes down to, isn't it? Like, I'm not psyched about this thing, so why should I do it? So yeah, I'm in the process of shutting it down right now, which means I'll no longer be a Belgium resident, which is a little sad. I love Belgium, but oh well.
But you know what? I think it reminds me actually of a Warren Buffett quote, which is his 5-25 rule. So list the 25 things you most want to do in life. Now separate out the first five from the last 20. The last 20 are still things you really want to do in life, but they're below the top five. And then his point is, never ever look at that bottom 20 again, because even though you really want to do them, you don't want to do them as much as that top five, and they will always distract from the top five.
I saw Ray Dalio in an interview say something similar. I doubt he came up with it. I think it's conventional wisdom, but it says you can have pretty much anything you want in this life. You can have it. You just can't have everything you want. You need to prioritize.
Yeah.
I love that.
That is good. Powerful. And so, Derek, I really want to hang out. You got to look me up next time you're in New York City.
Yeah, look me up when you're in New Zealand.
Which is never going to happen. That's not my hell yeah.
No, honestly, I will be in New York in a couple months. So I'll let you know. I miss it.
Excellent. I have three pianos in my apartment, so you're more than welcome to hang out and play one of them or all of them. So
okay. So the last thing I'm going to leave you with, and like I said, this is my last interview for a long, long time. So for one last time, I'm going to do something that people think I'm a little crazy for doing, is I'm going to give your listeners my email address, which is Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at Sivers, S-I-V-E-R-S, .org. And I do this because for years at conferences, I used to, when I was running CD Baby, I would go to all these music conferences and I'd bring a big stack of a few hundred business cards. And any person that asked, I would give them my business card. And so I would know how many I gave away. And I would often give away, like, say, 100, 200 business cards at conferences to musicians that wanted something from me. And then I would notice that, like, nobody would email. I would get, like, one follow-up from the entire conference. And, like, most people don't follow up. It's amazing. And the people that do, often I get these emails where people go like, oh, I don't know, I'm sure you're busy and I hate to be bothering you. And they're so apologetic, like, you know, how dare they bother me? But the thing is, you know, I wasn't coming on your show to like pitch my book. I don't care about it. I'm going to make another $8 if I sell 100 books, you know? So I really just do it for the people I meet. Like that's, I mean, honestly, I've been wanting to talk to you forever because you're just one of my favorite thinkers.
Thank you.
So this was an honor to finally chat with you. But, you know, the main reason instead of just making this a personal call, the main reason we're doing this public is for the people I meet. So yeah, if you have any questions for me or just want to say hi and introduce yourself, send me an email.
Well, I encourage people to write you because your book so much fits into the category of what I call a choose yourself book, career, vision, and so on. Why I wanted to talk to you. So I hope people email you.
Thank you. And I'll let you know when I'm in New York.
Excellent, Derek. Thanks so much.
See ya.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Goodbye.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network at jamesaltucher.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.